It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So you've probably heard the statistics, but half the world's population, 3 billion plus people, live on less than $2.50 a day. Every other person on the planet is very, very poor. So how did that happen, and why? Well, on the show today, we're going to explore the ideas about how we got to this point and how we can get out, about the haves and the have-nots. So let's start in Italy. 1971, and the government, inspired by the U.S. Peace Corps, starts a program
that allowed young men and women who did not want to join the army to go to Africa for 2 years instead.
This is Ernesto Ciroli, and at age 21, he wasn't that excited about the army.
I spoke at the time fluent French, and there was this interest for me to go and work with this agency.
And it seemed like a pretty good opportunity.
I very quickly became involved in the training of the volunteers.
He'd train them, and then he'd send them off to Africa with a project, and he'd say, "Don't forget to write."
And very often they would write two different letters. One letter to the boss, say everything is fine, and a letter to me, say, "Get me out of here."
So Ernesto, he got himself a nickname.
And my nickname was Tarmac, because I was the guy getting all the flu shots and then be sent to all these African countries, Kenya, Zambia, Ivory Coast, try to rescue these volunteers, Mali, Algeria, who were in sometimes in desperate situations. I was the guy who saw the problems and mistakes that were created by our very silly international aid programs.
Like this one. It happened in Zambia. And it's a story Ernesto Ciroli told on the TED stage.
Was a project where we Italians decided to teach Zambian people how to grow food. So we arrived there with Italian seeds in southern Zambia in this absolutely magnificent valley going down to the Zambezi River, and we taught the local people how to grow Italian tomatoes and zucchini. And of course, the local people had absolutely no interest in doing that, so we paid them to come and work, and sometimes they would show up. And we were amazed that the local people in such a fertile valley would not have any agriculture. But instead of asking them how come they were not growing anything, we simply said, "Thank God we're here." Just in the nick of time to save the Zambian people from starvation. And of course, everything in Africa grew beautifully, and we had these magnificent tomatoes. In Italy, a tomato will grow to this size, in Zambia, to this size. And we were telling the Zambians, look how easy agriculture is. When the tomatoes were nice and ripe and red, overnight, some 200 hippos came out from the river and they ate everything. And we said to the Zambians, "My God, the hippos!" And the Zambia said, "Yes, that's why we have no agriculture here." "Why didn't you tell us?" "You never asked." I thought it was only us Italians blundering around Africa, but then I saw what the Americans were doing, what the English were doing, what the French were doing, and after seeing what they were doing, I became quite proud of our project in Zambia, because you see, at least we fed the hippos.
And if you arrive in a community with arrogance and you don't listen to the local people, you don't ask, you are going to have your pride chewed off by the local hippos.
I mean, that was like a moment of clarity for you. I mean, this was like a turning point for you.
Yes. There was the moment of this kind of moment of clarity where you really sit back and say, we do not know what we're doing here. What are we doing? What the hell are we doing here? It was one of those revelations. It couldn't be clearer that for somebody to arrive in a country and to have this superior attitude towards the local, to say, why don't they grow anything here? Look how beautiful this land is.
Every single project that we set up in Africa failed. And I was distraught. I thought, age 21, that we Italians were good people and we were doing good work in Africa. Instead, everything we touched, we killed.
How did every single project fail?
And they still do. See, the first reaction was, let's not tell anybody. We made a mistake. Let's not tell anybody about this project. I really thought that it was one bad project that will never be repeated, which I think is what the Americans in the Peace Corps are thinking right now, that they are in a bad project, but it's unique. So what they do, they don't tell anybody what they've done because there must be lots and lots of good projects out there. But if they had the chance to go and find out what their colleagues are doing around Africa, they will discover that, in fact, the norm is failure. The question is, of 50 years of international aid, what can we point to that has been successful? In the last 50 years, the donor countries have donated to Africa $2 trillion American dollars, and the African continent is the only continent in the world that has not caught up with the alleviation of poverty, education, and health that the rest of the world has done.
I mean, there's a serious issue here. I mean, poverty is a real thing. It is a really serious thing that many people want to tackle, right? I mean, they want to fix this problem. So how do you do it without doing it?
Not by alms. You'd never solve problem of poverty by giving people money. You have to teach them how to fish.
I decided when I was 27 years old to only respond to people. And I invented a system called enterprise facilitation where you never initiate anything, you never motivate anybody, but you become a servant of the local passion, the servant of local people who have a dream to become a better person. So what you do, you shut up, you never arrive in a community with any ideas, and you sit with the local people. We don't work from offices. We meet at the cafe, we meet at the pub. We have zero infrastructure. And what we do, we become friends. And we find out what that person wants to do. The most important thing is passion. You can give somebody an idea. If that person doesn't want to do it, what are you going to do? The passion that the person has for her own growth is the most important thing. The passion that the man has for his own personal growth is the most important thing. And then we help them to go and find the knowledge, because nobody in the world can succeed alone. The person with the idea may not have the knowledge, but the knowledge is available. So years and years ago, I had this idea. Why don't we, for once, instead of arriving in a community to tell people what to do, why don't, for once, listen to them, but not in community meetings? What we do, we work one-on-one. And to work one-on-one, you had to create a social infrastructure that doesn't exist. You had to create a new profession. The profession is the family doctor of enterprise, the family doctor of business, who sits with you in your house, at your kitchen table, at the cafe, and helps you find the resources to transform your passion into a way to make a living.
I mean, that makes complete sense, but I mean, is the whole idea of sending aid wrong?
Completely, entirely wrong.
Wow.
Has to be dismantled. I wish we would set up a website called www.internationalblunders.com for people to come out of the closet and tell the truth about what they're doing.
I can't help but imagine, you know, like a young aid worker hearing this in despair and thinking, my God, I'm just doing the wrong thing. I mean, it can't possibly be the case for all of them.
It's never our intention, you see. The damage is not done by the original intent. The unintended consequences of what we're doing when we show up uninvited, when we don't know what we're doing. To do aid in Africa is like try to back a truck with three trailers. And every minimal change at the front is going to create an absolute huge effect three trailers back. All of a sudden, you lose control. And some of the stories are funny, but some of the stories are heartbreaking. And that's why I encourage more people who have done what I've done for the last 40, 50 years to come and tell the truth. What did they leave behind?
So we can create a community where we have facilitators who come from a small business background, sitting in cafes, in bars, and are your dedicated buddies. Somebody who will say to you, what do you need? What can you do? Can you make it? Okay, can you sell it? Can you look after the money? Oh no, I cannot do this. Would you like me to find you somebody? We activate communities. We have groups of volunteers supporting the enterprise facilitator to help you to find resources and people. And we have discovered that the miracle of the intelligence of local people is such that you can change the culture and the economy of this community just by capturing the passion, the energy, and imagination of your own people. Thank you.
Ernesto Ciroli. He works on enterprise projects all over the world. Check out his entire talk at ted.npr.org. Stay with us. More stories of the haves and have-nots in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, the haves and the have-nots. Krista, who is the richest person in history?
If you compared the wealth of individuals over time,
then you might think it's
the Roman patricians,
or
the Renaissance princes,
or
the American robber barons.
But you and I would be wrong, because the actual richest man, the winner, is
Carlos Slim, the Mexican billionaire.
So Carlos Slim is the richest person ever who ever lived.
Yeah, who ever lived.
Wow. So this is Krista Friedland. She wrote a book called Plutocrats, and it is about the super rich. And she says the fact that the richest man in history is alive right now, it says a lot about what's happening when it comes to the huge gap between the haves and the have-nots.
And that says that we really are living in a time of a disparity of fortune, which is greater than ever before.
It's amazing because you think about the richest people, right? And you think about huge disparities. And I mean, I don't know. I think of like Andrew Carnegie or J.D. Rockefeller or J.P. Morgan, you know, these guys that lived at a time when there was no law, there was no regulation, and you had massive disparities in wealth. But you're saying it's worse now.
It's certainly greater now.
And just how big is that gap between the super rich and the rest of us? Well, you might have to sit down for this one and brace yourself for some staggering numbers. Here's Krista on the TED stage.
In the 1970s, the 1% accounted for about 10% of the national income in the United States. Today, their share has more than doubled to above 20%. But what's even more striking is what's happening at the very tippy top of the income distribution. The 0.1% in the U.S. today account for more than 8% of the national income. They are where the 1% was 30 years ago. Now, as it happens, Warren Buffett likes to point out that in 1992, the combined wealth of the people on the Forbes 400 list, the 400 richest Americans, was $300 billion. Just think about it. You didn't even need to be a billionaire to get on that list in 1992. Well, today, that figure has more than quintupled to $1.7 trillion. And I probably don't need to tell you that we haven't seen anything similar happen to the middle class, whose wealth has stagnated, if not actually decreased.
I think one reason that we don't notice is because the overall culture is in many ways one of symbolic equality in ways that didn't exist in the past. You know, in past times, what you wore was determined by how rich you were. Today, billionaires wear jeans. Today, people like Bill Gates brag about how much they like eating Big Macs. So I think that tends to paper over a little bit how big the gap is. I think the other thing is that today's explosion of super wealth is partly a function of globalization. Right? It's meaningful that the richest person who ever lived is a Mexican. The fact that all of these countries, all of these people, hundreds of millions, billions of people who were left out of the Industrial Revolution are now coming online. And that is another force which is creating these super fortunes.
For the first time in history, if you are an energetic entrepreneur with a brilliant new idea, you have almost frictionless access to a global market of more than a billion people. As a result, if you are very, very smart and very, very lucky, you can get very rich very quickly. The latest poster boy for this phenomenon is David Karp. The 26-year-old founder of Tumblr recently sold his company to Yahoo for $1.1 billion. Think about that for a minute. $1.1 billion, 26 years old. Those same largely positive forces which are driving the rise of the global plutocracy also happen to be hollowing out the middle class. And in contrast with the Industrial Revolution, the titans of our new economy aren't creating that many new jobs. At its zenith, GM employed hundreds of thousands. Facebook, fewer than 10,000. The terrifying reality is that our countries are getting richer, our companies are getting more efficient, but we're not creating more jobs, and we're not paying people as a whole more. What worries me more is a different nightmare scenario, is a universe in which a few geniuses invent Google and its ilk, and the rest of us are employed giving them massages.
I mean, sounds like what you're saying almost is that the way we've implemented capitalism has almost failed most people in the world.
It's not a verdict on the whole history of capitalism, but it is true that it is not delivering for the vast majority of the population. And we have to do something about it. And there is a sort of a group of people at the summit of global business who, as they put it, worry that their social mandate to operate will be taken away if these forces of rising income inequality and a squeezed middle class are allowed to go too much further. And I think that's a smart thing to worry about, because if our economic systems continue to deliver for the very top, but not to deliver for everybody else, people are going to say, you know what? This is not an economic system that I agree with. And I worry that we won't come up with a smart, moderate set of responses in time. But I really think it's going to be, you know, about hard work on many individual fronts. Every time we're looking at a social problem, every time a company is looking at a decision, pause and say, okay, what will the impact be on the squeezed middle class? And if enough of us start working that way and thinking that way, then I think collectively we'll start coming up with a set of answers that work.
Krista Freeland. She's the author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. She's also a newly minted politician with the center-left Liberal Party of Canada. You can see her entire talk at ted.npr.org. Okay, really rich people, but what about really rich countries? Well, for the past 500 years, the story has basically been the West and then the rest.
People in the West, meaning Western Europe and places where West Europeans settled, got a lot richer than everybody else.
This is Neil Ferguson. He's an economic historian at Harvard. And he says that people who live in the West today
have two-thirds of the private wealth, and the great majority of people who live elsewhere make do with the rest.
So the question is, why? What happened in the last 500 years to create such a huge gap? And why did Western countries suddenly begin to pull away from the rest? Well, here's Neil's explanation from his TED Talk.
This wasn't just an economic story. If you take the 10 countries that went on to become the Western empires, in 1500, they were really quite tiny, 5% of the world's land surface, 16% of its population, maybe 20% of its income. By 1913, these 10 countries plus the United States controlled vast global empires. Now, you can't just blame this on imperialism, though many people have tried to do so. Samuel Johnson, the great lexicographer, posed it through his character Rasselas in his novel Rasselas, A Prince of Abyssinia, published in 1759. By what means are the Europeans thus powerful, or why, since they can so easily visit Asia and Africa for trade or conquest, cannot the Asiatics and Africans invade their coasts, plant colonies in their ports, and give laws to their natural princes? The same wind that carries them back would bring us thither. That's a great question. And you know what? It was also being asked at roughly the same time by the Westerners, by the people in the rest of the world, like Ibrahim Muteferika, an Ottoman official, the man who introduced printing very belatedly to the Ottoman Empire, who said in a book published in 1731, "Why do Christian nations, which were so weak in the past compared with Muslim nations, begin to dominate so many lands in modern times and even defeat the once victorious Ottoman armies?" Unlike Rasselas, Muteferika had an answer to that question, which was correct. He said it was because they have laws and rules invented by reason.
Not geography, not imperialism. The West won, at least according to Neil Ferguson, because of its ideas and institutions, six of them he calls killer apps.
I called them the killer apps because it seemed like a way of annoying academics who hate that kind of thing. So the killer apps were, number one, competition, science in the sense of the scientific method, the rule of law based on private property rights, modern medicine, the consumer society, and the work ethic. Those six things arose in the West first. They explain why the West got so much richer. But here's the killer app of the argument. Once non-Western societies began to copy those ideas and institutions, once they downloaded the killer apps, lo and behold, they started to experience growth.
Let me very briefly tell you what I mean by this, synthesizing the work of many economic historians in the process. Competition means not only were there 100 different political units in Europe in 1500, but within each of these units there was competition between corporations as well as sovereigns. The ancestor of the modern corporation, the City of London Corporation, existed in the 12th century, Nothing like this existed in China, where there was one monolithic state covering a fifth of humanity, and anyone with any ambition had to pass one standardized examination, which took 3 days and was very difficult and involved memorizing vast numbers of characters and very complex Confucian essay writing. The scientific revolution was different from the science that had been achieved in the Oriental world in a number of crucial ways, the most important being that through the experimental method, it gave men control over nature in a way that had not been possible before. Example, Benjamin Robbins's extraordinary application of Newtonian physics to ballistics. Once you do that, your artillery becomes accurate. Think of what that means. That really was a killer application. Property rights. It's not the democracy, folks. It's having the rule of law based on private property rights. Most people in rural North America owned some land by 1900. Hardly anyone in South America did. That's another killer app. Modern medicine in the late 19th century began to make major breakthroughs against the infectious diseases that killed a lot of people. And this was another killer app, the very opposite of a killer, because it doubled and then more than doubled human life expectancy. The consumer society is what you need for the Industrial Revolution to have a point. You need people to want to wear tons of clothes. You've all bought an article of clothing in the last month, I guarantee it. That's the consumer society, and it propels economic growth more than even technological change itself. Japan was the first non-Western society to embrace it. The alternative, which was proposed by Mahatma Gandhi, was to institutionalize and make poverty permanent. Very few Indians today wish that India had gone down Mahatma Gandhi's road. Finally, the work ethic. Any culture can get the work ethic if the institutions are there to create the incentive to work. Who's got the work ethic now? You probably assume that because the iPhone was designed in California but assembled in China, that the West still leads in terms of technological innovation. You're wrong. In terms of patents, there's no question that the East is ahead. Not only has Japan been ahead for some time, South Korea has gone into third place, and China is just about to overtake Germany. Why? Because the killer apps can be downloaded. It's open source. Any society can adopt these institutions, and when they do, they achieve what the West achieved after 1500, only faster. This is the great reconvergence, and it's the biggest story of your lifetime, because it's on your watch that this is happening. The average American used to be more than 20 times richer than the average Chinese. Now it's just 5 times, and soon it will be 2.5 times. And this is part of a really extraordinary phenomenon. And that is the end of the Great Divergence.
When you think about this gap that's closing and this reconvergence, where are we going to be in 10 or 20 or 50 years? Will we eradicate poverty?
I think it's a plausible future at the moment that the great reconvergence will continue, but I find it very hard to believe that we will get to unity. In other words, that per capita GDP in China will end up being the same as per capita GDP in the United States. And the reason I doubt that is that if the Chinese lived the way we do, it's highly unlikely that the world would be able to sustain the environmental outcome. There's another future in which China, because it hasn't really achieved a full transition to free political and legal institutions, falls apart. So before we simply conclude that history is a one-way bet on convergence or reconvergence, we need to consider these other scenarios in which things go wrong in China and they go right here.
When you look at the world through the prism of history, which is the way you do look at the world, because of course you're a historian, do you ever think that because of the way it worked out, the haves, the countries that have things, have a responsibility to sort out the rest or to help get them to a better place?
I believe they have a moral responsibility, but they also have self-interest. It's not advantageous for the wealthy countries of the West to inhabit a planet alongside impoverished countries. The growth of China has been enormously beneficial to the United States and indeed to Europe over the last 30 years. Indeed, had it not been for China's sustained growth, the financial crisis would have been a great deal worse. There is no reason why we should want the world to stay the way it is, with a fifth of the world's population owning two-thirds of the wealth. There's no moral reason and there's no rational justification for that inequality. It's just the legacy of the past.
Neil Ferguson. His most recent book is called The Great Degeneration. Find his full talk at ted.npr.org. Our show this week, The Haves, The Have-Nots, What Explains Inequality, and Ideas for How to Fix It. I'm Guy Raz. Stay with us. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And our show this week is all about the haves and the have-nots, and ideas on how we got here and ways to fix it. So a few years ago, TED put together a conference that was all about Africa. Poverty, problems, success stories, and also some very blunt talk.
Helping Africa is noble, but helping Africa has been turned into a theater of the absurd. It's like the blind leading the clueless.
This is George Aite, and he says when it comes to closing the gap between the haves and the have-nots, especially in Africa, money doesn't actually work.
Since 1960, the West has pumped more than $600 billion into Africa in the form of aid, but there's nothing to show for it.
George was born and raised in Ghana. He's an economist now, and he lives in the U.S., but he still travels to Africa a lot, and he raises money to help small businesses there. And his recommendation for tackling poverty in Africa? To take the people he calls the hippos and replace them with the cheetahs.
The cheetah generation is a new breed of Africans. They understand what accountability and democracy is. They're not going to wait for government to do things for them. That's the cheetah generation. And Africa's salvation rests on the backs of these cheetahs. In contrast, of course, we have the hippo generation. The hippo generation are the ruling elites. You ask them to reform their economies, they're not going to reform it because they benefit from the rotten status quo. Now, there are a lot of Africans who are very angry at the condition of Africa. Now, we're talking about a continent which is not poor. It is rich in mineral resources, natural mineral resources. But the mineral wealth of Africa is not being utilized to lift its people out of poverty. There are certain things that we need to recognize. Africa's begging bowl leaks horribly. There are people who think that we should pour more money, more aid into this bowl which leaks. What are the leakages? Corruption alone costs Africa $148 billion a year. Capital flight out of Africa, $80 billion a year. Let's take food imports. Every year, Africa spends $20 billion to import food. Now, back in the 1960s, Africa not only fed itself, it also exported food. Not anymore. We know that something has gone fundamentally wrong.
I wonder, George, if, when people heard your TED Talk, I mean, some people must have said, why are you blaming Africa? I mean, the problem isn't just our own doing.
See, you have to be an African in order to be able to appreciate that. When I was growing up, there are those who argued that, Africa is an innocent victim. They blame Africa's woes on the slave trade, Western imperialism, colonialism, and much of it is true. But, it was a convenient alibi for African leaders to use to cover up their own failures. And this is one of the reasons why African leaders, were always, each time they drew up a budget, they held a bowl in their hands and went to this, Western countries and begged for aid. But after a while, people got fed up and said that, okay, look, colonialism didn't leave Africa in a good state. But there are also internal factors which have held Africa back. Bad leadership, oppression, senseless civil wars, which have destroyed many African countries.
I guess I wonder whether there's reasons to be optimistic.
No, there is reason to be optimistic. And the reason to be optimistic comes from those that are called the cheetah generation.
How old are they?
Well, you see, you're talking about Africans who are in their 30s and 40s. They don't subscribe to this colonial mentality and blame colonialism and that sort of thing. They can see things for themselves.
So how can they help?
Well, you know, I have spent a lot of time traveling in African villages. Poor families, they get up very early in the morning. They go to their farms. They break their back. And
okay, so at this point, let me just break in for a moment, because George describes in great detail one of the projects he's working on in Ghana. And this is the part you should know.
Most of the peasant farmers in Africa are women.
The typical woman farmer.
You know, let's suppose that, you know, this woman produces tomatoes.
And she and the other farmers bring those tomatoes to the closest market.
By carrying it on their heads.
So they can carry 40 to 50 tomatoes max, but whatever they can't carry,
they leave on their farms to rot.
Which is why, he says, the farmers are always struggling just to get by. So what George is trying to do is to get those young Ghanaians, the cheetahs,
to set up, let's say, a tomato marketing company.
And then that marketing company would go to the farmers and say,
grow as much tomatoes as possible. We have the truck. We will come and we can buy all the tomatoes that you want.
So the cheetahs are the new middlemen, but everything else he's talking about, the traditional farming, the marketplace, that's pretty much business as usual.
In traditional Africa, the means of production is privately owned. It's owned by extended families. The extended family system pulls its resources together. They own farms. They decide what to do, what to produce. They don't take any orders from their chiefs. And when they produce their crops, when they make a profit, it is theirs to keep. What do we do now? Go back to Africa's indigenous institutions. And this is where we charge the cheetahs to go into the informal sectors, the traditional sectors, to instigate change from within. And I know that with the cheetahs, we can take Africa back one village at a time. Thank you very much.
George Ayite, he wrote a whole book on this. It's called Africa Unchained. His full talk can be found at TED.com. You have a very specific definition of poverty, because most people say poverty is a lack of money, but it's not so simple.
No. For me, poverty is a lack of choice. It's a lack of opportunity. And certainly income is a piece of it, but it is not the only piece.
This is Jacqueline Novogratz, and the way she ended up working on poverty started in kind of a roundabout way with a job interview.
The interviewer asked me why I wanted to be a banker, and not being one who was able to lie, said that I really didn't want to be a banker, but that my parents made me go through the interview process. And then he told me that this particular banking job would have me traveling to 40 countries in 3 years, seeing the economic and political processes of those countries. And I literally said, do you think we might start this interview over?
So she, of course, got the job, and she did that for a while, but in the back of her mind, she always felt that there was something missing.
Banking was wonderful, except it wasn't reaching the poor, who not only had no access to credit in formal terms, but they wouldn't even walk through the doors of the bank.
So she quit. She just up and quit and took off for Africa.
Which was a continent I knew very little about. I just packed my bags and left.
My first introduction was at the Abidjan airport on a sweaty Ivory Coast morning. I had just left Wall Street, cut my hair to look like Margaret Mead, given away most everything that I owned, and arrived with all the essentials, some poetry, a few clothes, and of course a guitar, because I was going to save the world, and I thought I would just start with the African continent. But literally within days of arriving, I was told in no uncertain terms by a number of West African women that Africans didn't want saving, thank you very much, least of all not by me. I was too young, unmarried, had no children, didn't really know Africa, and besides, my French was pitiful. So it was an incredibly painful time in my life. And yet, it really started to give me the humility to start listening.
If I was going to be effective, I had to start by listening. I had to start by trying to understand the context in which I was working in a real way and not be there from a sense of moral benevolence, but rather from a sense of partnership. And in many ways, the gift of that was immediate immersion. And so it happened quickly.
So I moved to Kenya and worked in Uganda, and I met a group of Rwandan women who asked me in 1986 to move to Kigali to help them start the first microfinance institution there. And I did, and we ended up naming it Dutarembere, meaning to go forward with enthusiasm. And while we were doing it, I realized that there weren't a lot of businesses that were viable and started by women, and so maybe I should try to run a business too.
And what did you find there when you got there to Rwanda?
I was introduced to this group of single mothers that were part of this charity project to keep them, quote-unquote, employed, making these little baked goods. And I made a deal with this group that if they let me transform the group into a business, a proper business where we rose and fell with our success, that I would take this on.
First of all, I thought, well, we need a sales team, and we clearly aren't the A team here. So I did all this training. And the epitome was when I literally marched into the streets of Nyamirambo, which is the popular quarter of Kigali, with a bucket, and I sold all these little donuts to people. And I came back, and I was like, you see? And the women said, you know, Jacqueline, who in Nyamirambo is not going to buy donuts out of an orange bucket from a tall American woman? And it's a good point. So then I went the whole American way with competitions, team and individual, completely failed. But over time, the women learned to sell on their own way, and they started listening to the marketplace, and they came back with ideas for cassava chips and banana chips and sorghum bread, and before you knew it, we had cornered the Kigali market, and the women were earning 3 to 4 times the national average.
So you really helped these women get this bakery off the ground.
My role wasn't to make everything work. My role was to be the cheerleader, the finance person, and also I could connect us to the embassies and the bigger organizations in town who may not have trusted the group without that go-between. And that's really what allowed us to build this ultimately pretty remarkable pocket in Kigali.
And with that confidence surge, I thought, well, it's time to create a real bakery, so let's paint it. The women said, that's a really great idea. And I said, well, what color do you want to paint it? And they said, well, you choose. And I said, no, I'm learning to listen. You choose. It's your bakery, your street, your country, not mine. But they wouldn't give me an answer. So 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks went by. And finally I said, well, how about blue? And they said, blue, we love blue, let's do it blue. So I went to the store, I bought all this paint and fabric to make curtains. And on painting day, we all gathered in Nyamirambo, and blue, everything became blue. The walls were blue, the windows were blue, the sidewalk out front was painted blue. And at the end of it, we stood across the street and we looked at what we had done. And I said, it is so beautiful. And the women said, it really is. And I said, and I think the color's perfect. And they all nodded their head except for Godance. And I said, what? And she said, nothing. And I said, what? And she said, well, it is pretty, but you know our color really, it is green. And and I learned then that listening isn't just about patience, but that when you've lived on charity and dependent your whole life long, it's really hard to say what you mean. And mostly because people never really ask you, and when they do, you don't really think they want to know the truth. And so that I learned that listening is not only about waiting, but it's also learning how better to ask questions.
When you first went to Africa to try to do something, to try to do something about poverty, what is it that you didn't know that you know now?
I think the most important was that I didn't understand. When you look at people living in poverty, And you're coming from not just the West. You're coming from parts of society where markets work, where government works. You have this assumption that you can use that same lens in identifying solutions. In truth, poor people live in political economies, not market economies. Poor people are in places where everyone has their hands in that community's future, whether it is government or exploitive capitalists in some senses or mafias. That's a very complicated ecosystem, if you will, with which to interact. And that's probably been my biggest growth, is understanding that. The solutions will come from more of a quest than a prepackaged set of ideas.
And so on a micro level, there's a real role for this combination of investment and philanthropy. And so it was really those lessons that made me decide to build Acumen Fund about 6 years ago. It's a nonprofit venture capital fund for the poor. A few oxymorons in one sentence. It essentially raises charitable funds from individuals, foundations, and corporations, and then we turn around and we invest equity and loans in both for-profit and nonprofit entities that deliver affordable health, housing, energy, clean water to low-income people in South Asia and Africa so that they can make their own choices.
I mean, aside from like the obvious moral reasons, right? I mean, why should people who have stuff, right? I mean, like, what incentives or interests do they have in helping to equalize the income gap?
Well, first of all, I would never shy away from moral reasons. They're so connected to political reasons, economic reasons, because at the base of it is what it means to live in a sustainable world. If we want to create a thriving world as we careen toward 10 billion, we need to move away from seeing the 3 billion not as hungry mouths to feed, but rather innovators and entrepreneurs and teachers and songwriters. And the more that we see each other, the more there is not only a moral obligation, but a financial, a political, an economic, a social opportunity to build a world where we can truly flourish.
In some ways, it's not even about conquering poverty. It's about giving dignity.
It's about giving dignity. Believing that you have a chance as a human being to be a greater part in determining your own destiny.
Jacqueline Novogratz, she heads up the Acumen Fund. She wrote a book about some of the things you just heard. It's called The Blue Sweater. And she has five, count them, five talks at TED.com, all of them pretty cool.
Oh, baby, what I wouldn't do with plenty of money and you, in spite of the worry that money brings, just a little filthy lucre buys a lot of things, and I could take you to places you'd like to go. But outside of that, I've no use for dough. It's the root of all evil, of strife and upheaval. But I'm certain, honey, that life would be sunny with plenty of money and you.
Hey, thanks for listening to our show this week on the haves and have-nots. If you missed any of it, or if you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who's on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at TED.com, and you can download this program through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.